Welcome to Haldane's Law Matters. Thank you. Today, Aaron Pang is my guest. And Aaron, can I say firstly, of course, as always, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure is mine.
And I'm going to start, rather than telling everyone who you are exactly, to say this, that you're an unusual guest because we're a law firm and Haldane's Law Matters deals with either legal matters or geopolitics. That's the way it seems to have come about over the last few months and years. And you don't fit into either category naturally. So why are you here? I'm going to tell you. You're here because you have built a reputation for self-improvement as an author and as a podcaster and with a club, which you're going to talk about in a minute, I hope. And where you fit into Haldane's Law Matters is this. You won't be surprised to hear that as a criminal defense lawyer, I deal with a lot of stressful clients. People that have been charged with criminal offences, who are either saying, look, I did it and I need you to help me get the lightest sentence possible, please. Or, I know I'm accused of it, but I didn't do it. Can you defend me? So it really does create tension. And not only, by the way, tension for the person that's being accused by the state of a criminal offence, but also the family. And there's many occasion, Aaron, when I'm told by my clients, and I'm pleased when they say this in a way, that I'm more like a therapist than a lawyer. I think it's a compliment, but I'm not quite sure. Anyway, so I see my job obviously to get the best result for them, but the best result also involves keeping them sane. And we also have a matrimonial department, and I'm told reliably by my colleagues in that department that the stresses and strains of couples going through divorce, separation, trying to work out their married life causes similar stresses. So I thought it would be helpful if we started this podcast, this conversation, by firstly, now, if you will, just give me a very brief background as to who you are and why you're here. And I know the answers, of course, but my viewers may not. And then let's talk about what you think the best approach to people in my position dealing with stressed clients or my matrimonial colleagues dealing with their matrimonially stressed clients. Please introduce yourself.
Jonathan, first of all, thank you so much for having me here. Hopefully I'm not in your office for bad matter. We're here for a conversation, like you said. A bit of background about myself. I was born and raised in Hong Kong and had an opportunity to study abroad. So I did spend about 10 years, like a decade, living in Australia. I do think I have a unique upbringing in the sense that I experienced sort of the typical Asian setting growing up in an Asian family where my dad is a high achiever, is a doctor, pseudo politician. And after my mom gave birth to me, she decided to give up on a career. And I also have a younger brother. So having spent 30 years of my lifeline in Hong Kong and 10 years in Australia, that have given me a very diverse perspectives, mixing the East and West. As to why I'm here, it's actually not my first time in a law firm. About half a year ago, we did a workshop with another law firm speaking about developing a positive mindset to help law professionals to navigate change and also to help them build high performance. I'm no stranger to stress. And as a matter of fact, I didn't even know I was stressed for a very long part of my life. And the issue with stress, and the way I see it, is there is good stress and there is bad stress. Good stress are the moments where you are being thrown into unfamiliar territories, uncharted waters. But then at the back of your head, it gives you this motivation to push forward. I see them as good stress. The bad stress are the situations where you're being thrown into adverse situations where you have no idea how to react. And then everything becomes very, very reactive. And I've certainly had the different moments of those in the past. And we shared it privately when we met less than 2 weeks ago. And what led me to writing and podcasting and also to public speaking was really a catalyst that happened in my life in 2019. And I think as human beings, it's often the case where you live a very comfortable life. We like comfort. We like to be in control. We like to be able to predict things. But then life humbles you in so many ways. And it happened to me in 2019. So there were two catalysts. The first one, I had a little personal life crisis with my first newborn son. He was about to turn 3 months and he suffocated in my arms for about 5 minutes. He survived and is alive today. but for about 6 months, I was not able to sleep well. My emotions were not proportional to these situations. I was anxious all the time, scared all the time, had a lot of guilt after that happened, and thinking to myself that I wasn't a good enough father. And that also happened at the height of a social movement. And on the back of that, I decided to go on a digital news detox because I realized a lot of my negativity built up was coming from the media outlets, from imageries and videos that people were circulating at the time. So I stopped watching news altogether. And 5 months later, I left a message on someone's post on Facebook. And literally, I just wrote what happened, because I had no context about why he wrote that post. It was basically like a black image that he posted on Facebook. Went to sleep. And next morning, I woke up, I was trolled. I got kicked out from two WhatsApp groups. And it made me feel very sad. And then it was a month later, so I started asking myself, so what is my purpose? What am I doing here? And how can I best contribute to the next generation so that my kids and their friends can live in a more positive world? And that sudden shift of thought led me to writing and podcasting 2 years later, speaking 5 years later, and now to having this incredible conversation with you at your office.
You're very kind. So social media and the news played a part in your anxiety, along with a very specific event, of course, that you were worried about, your son's mortality. You were in a position where you thought he was possibly going to die. And that's about as sobering as it gets. So you must have been actually quite badly hurt by that immediately and inevitably. And it's led you to a whole new life path. Would that be the way you see it?
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah. And just because it's a conversation, this, let me tell you that I too go on news detox every so often. I normally last about 3 weeks. And the thing that surprises me most, firstly, is how good you feel. I mean, you feel good, because most of it's awful. And then secondly, when you turn back on, nothing's changed. I mean, the same sort of headlines. It's a war here, a political row there, only present Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
So it goes on. And so it just strikes me that if you can actually turn off the news every so often, if people can understand that that's really beneficial for them, they won't miss much. That's a good start, isn't it?
Mm. There is a lot of power to decide when we want to switch off. And I agree with you 100% that sometimes we just need to switch off from some outlets so that we can take a moment to have peace and recharge and to keep going. And an analogy that I love to use is whenever we get on plane, they always tell us to put on our oxygen mask first before we put on oxygen mask for other people.
Yeah,
I think there's a lot of wisdom to that. And when I look back at how much time I spent on social media and news outlet, I always like to ask myself two questions. First of all, what am I responsible for in everything that I'm consuming?
Yeah.
And the second question I like to reflect on is, what can I do about it? If I'm not responsible for it and I can't do something about it, it's better for me to spend more time on things that are within my control where I could impact and influence our circle of supporters, of allies. And hopefully, by empowering these people, they can then go on and become the positive voices in a society that can help effect more changes.
So it is a question, isn't it, of trying to identify what you can worry about productively versus simply wearing yourself out with worry because there's nothing you can do about it. And it makes me think of an anecdotal story concerning a client. Now, I won't mention the name of the client, but it was a long piece of criminal litigation. And I was talking to this client about worries, because we were sitting outside a courtroom for a long time waiting for a judgment to come back. And the conversation went along the lines of, goodness, you must be very concerned and worried waiting this time outside court for a judgment that could change your whole life. And he said, I'm not actually. And I said, crikey, how do you manage that? And he said, well, I'll tell you, I fly a lot. And if you fly a lot, there are going to be times when it doesn't feel great. You're in a storm and it's bouncing around and so on. And I go on reading or listening to music. And I do that because there's a pilot at the front who's looking after me. And there's nothing my worry will do to assist the pilot in the task he has of taking us through this safely. And I thought that was beautifully put and shows a lot of wisdom and control over a life. That person had control over his own life because he had control over his emotions and his ability to identify what he could or could not influence.
Yeah. And it's kind of like to your story, and I love this story, and it's almost like in the moment, you've asked yourself whether you've done your best.
Yeah.
You've done the best possible.
Yeah.
And then you're leaning with someone that you trust.
Yes. So that takes us back to law, because I feel the weight of responsibility when a person comes into me and says, this is my moment, I've been accused of a criminal offence. And the worst ones to deal with in terms of emotion are normally the first-time offenders, the only time perhaps in their life they're going to be in trouble, because they're not used to it. I mean, occasionally you get someone that's been 5 times charged and 3 times in prison, and they have a more sanguine view of life. It's their life. But not for the businessman that's perhaps accused of something in business, who can see the whole of his life unraveling if things go wrong. So when we're talking about this, Aaron, it's not just actually the client we have to worry about. We have to worry about the solicitor as well, because it's shared. I mean, I feel it.
Mm.
I can feel the tension sometimes.
Yes. Myself.
In fact, I'm probably not that good at isolating myself from it.
Mm.
So given that somebody comes into a firm of solicitors, and I'm going to take a specific example because it's one that resonates. It happens from time to time, and it happened not long ago, that a young fellow, I think he was probably in his 16, 17, 18 year old, I can't remember, and he was lounging on a sofa in a conference room next door from where we are now. And he came in with his mother, who was not very old, and she was a youngish mother. And he came in because he had been charged with being in possession of a dangerous drug. And the likelihood, because it wasn't his first time, was that there was a good likelihood that he'd either go to prison or to drug addiction treatment center by way of a sentence. And what I was talking to him about was trying to find an alternative to that to present to the court. I said, look, if you were to go into treatment now, but you're on bail, there's time, go into treatment, and we can show the court that you're taking your problem seriously. And we identified a potential in-house solution for that treatment. And the young fellow was not terribly likable. He was very arrogant, rather rude to his mother. And when I suggested this, he said, do I get my own room and will there be television? So I realized that this was a privileged young man that was abusing his privilege and didn't have a handle on reality.
Mm.
And I asked his mother if she could leave the room for a moment or two while I spoke to him. And I told him that the likelihood in my experience was that the next piece of news I heard would be that he was dead from an overdose. Because unless you start tackling what was in fact in this instance a heroin problem, The chances of survival were poor. Now, I've been in the business long enough to do that. Younger solicitors probably wouldn't have asked the mother to leave and they wouldn't have been so forthright with their client.
Mm.
By the way, it worked. He went into a room without a television, without aircon and the rest. And I can't remember the outcome in court, but I think it helped. So my question to you, Aaron, is what are the ways for a family or an individual that's in a very specific problem? This isn't imaginary for them. It's genuine. It's a real problem. What do you think the best solution is for them to get themselves to the end of the tunnel and into light again?
Before I start, Jonathan, I just want to say that I was so intrigued by your story. I feel like I should invite you on my podcast too.
I'll look forward to it, Aaron.
I'd love to listen to the development of the rest of the story. Parenting is an interesting journey, isn't it?
It is.
Right? As a parent, and I'm a parent of 2 young boys, I feel like as parents, a lot of the times we really want to teach our kids the right values. And sometimes I feel like as parents, we teach life lessons to children prematurely. Because all of us as grown-ups, as professionals, lawyers, we have so much baggages that we are carrying that sometimes we want to instill this wisdom, intelligence into the next generation so that we want to give them guardrails so that they stay on the right path. But then if I strip back to what made us who we are today, what made you into a lawyer, it's not because you didn't fail. It was because of a repetition of failures, difficult events, difficult environment, mean people you might have met along the way, which shape your passion, your purpose into doing what you do today. So I often say that there are 3 things that shape a person's character. So those 3 things are environment, how you grew up, significant event which happened in your life, and people that you have around you. And I think the biggest gift is for any person is to have clarity around how those three things shape them into who they are today and what they're missing. And if we go back to the conversation that we have around social media, for instance, what I am seeing on social media is there's this very toxic internet culture where influencers will do anything just to get eyeballs. If given the opportunity, I would love to have a conversation with that young fella to really understand how those three things shape,
shape
him up.
What drives him?
Yeah. Why did he develop a dependence on drugs?
Can I just interrupt to say that the use of drugs, particularly by young people, it is causing huge problems. And I was having a discussion with somebody about my age, actually, who had had his own problems with a drug known as alcohol. Same thing. Legalized drug.
Yeah.
And he'd fought it and gone to AA, come through the experience and been free of it for years. And he was making the simple comment that doesn't matter what the drug is, be it alcohol or marijuana or heroin and all the other things that are so damaging, the drug is the elastoplast. What the injury is underneath that plaster is the issue. And you're really difficult to solve the drug problem in an individual if you don't know what caused them to put the elastoplast on.
Precisely.
To mask the real issue. Now, is that your experience dealing with depression and people that are off track and wanting to get back on track? Does that resonate for you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
It resonates with me because there was a period of time where I was binge drinking when I first moved back to Asia.
Yeah.
And I was on autopilot. You would find me in Lan Kwai Fong every Friday, Saturday. I was downing 10, 15 shots.
Yeah.
Oh. There was a period of time where I got into gambling when I was in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like you said, heroin is just one of the distractions, one of the tools that people decided to lean in when they really haven't sorted out what's sitting underneath that.
So if you don't mind, can I use your experience to understand this better? Because I think it was nail biting. For years, I couldn't stop nail biting.
I'm going to check out your nails now.
They're fabulous. And I'll tell you, by the way, I solved my problem by a partner, my girlfriend, who was a clinical psychologist, saying, I'll tell you what, it's a behavioral thing. Why don't you try hypnosis? And one session of hypnosis took me out from being an acute nail biter, which I hated, but I hated being a nail biter. And from there on, you can see they're okay.
They're perfect.
Yeah, they're perfect. So that was my experience of anxiety.
Hmm.
And interestingly enough, my son, who is 19, I hope he doesn't mind me mentioning this, was telling me the other day that he had anxiety. And he said, Dad, I've seen you. I've seen your anxiety. I know you're driven by anxiety is part of your makeup. And you use it for your clients, good. And you use it socially for good. And I'm going to learn to turn my anxiety to positivity rather than the other way around. I thought that was tremendously moving. I was so impressed.
I would be if I were you, if I were in your position.
Yeah.
And we often say that there are no good or bad emotions.
Yeah.
Behind every emotion, there's an intention, right?
Yes.
Sadness drives empathy.
Yep.
Anger can drive action.
Yes.
When you truly believe in something. And going back to your bite nailing example, that took willpower. That took self-awareness for you to be aware of this behavior. And that also took curiosity for you to try a different tool so that you can now try to replace that with another solution.
Yeah.
Right? So there were at least three things at play
which
caused a shift in behavior.
So, yeah, self-awareness is important and determination and decision. I mean, people underestimate, I find, the power of a decision. There's so much ambivalence, so much I don't care in the world, particularly for the young, Gen Z, is that right, Gen Z? The ones that are lying flat, apparently. There doesn't seem to be much decision-making, and there is ambivalence about what the world is offering them, what they can actually get hold of and make their lives meaningful.
Yeah. I want to touch on the Gen Z comment that you just mentioned. I personally have worked with a lot of hardworking Gen Z. I've got interns working with us, and they are super driven, motivated. And this young fellow in particular, he's grew up in Hong Kong, came from Philippines, and grew through the local system, and he can speak fluent Cantonese and Tagalog. So there are young people who are driven with like-minded values. But I think where we have failed as a society is we haven't cultivated enough social models for the young people to learn from. And I go back to social media where young people are learning to do whatever they need to get validation through likes and comments, and the algorithm from the machine is driving them to think and react in a tunnel vision. So I hear a lot of comments about Gen Z is very different, and it goes back to three things that we spoke about: the events, the people, and the environment, and how they're being raised.
Mm. And friends.
And yeah.
Surround yourself with non-fractious people, with sensible, decent people.
Yeah, exactly.
Let it rub off you.
Yeah. And we touch on substance and drugs, but remember back in the 60s and 70s, smoking used to be really cool.
Mm.
And we got all those ads, you know, masculine man riding on beautiful horses.
Yes.
Right?
Marlboro man.
Right? And that's how a lot of people got into smoking and yeah. alcohol, mm. right? Drugs are no different than those days. Monkey sees, monkey does things. If they're surrounded by mean friends and they're all into drugs, and if they're not feeling the love and the belonging and the authenticity at home,
mm.
these kids will look elsewhere. There was a very rough period of my time where I went to a new school in grade 9, haters from my basketball team. There were a lot of conflicts at home, and I had no friends in a new school environment. And there was a period of time that I was trying to join triads. I was 14.
Mm.
And I made a decision, my life would have been very different today. So yeah, we have a lot of problems with the next generation. And hence, that really drives me into what I do through writing and podcasting and speaking to other people. I feel like we need more quiet and positive voices, not just in Hong Kong, but all over the world. If you look at LinkedIn, for example, statistics have shown that only 1% of people post on LinkedIn.
It's 1% of the population. Yeah. Which population, by the way? Because it must vary a lot from
yeah, exactly.
country to country.
Yeah.
Can I, just picking up with this then, we've got listeners that are probably saying to themselves, goodness, I could do with help. So can I just first of all give you a little plug? Your podcast is Transformative Purpose.
That's right.
Transformative Purpose. So you talk about these things on a regular basis through your podcast. And then you've also got, can I just understand this, a club where people can join? And what? Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's called a Purpose Club.
Okay. So purpose is important to you.
Purpose is important. What I realized was purpose is our superpower. Like we've discussed, purpose also gives us a way to help us refuel. When we get lost in the sea, we can always go back to our purpose and ask. So there are three things that I talked about within the rims of transformative purpose. And how that came about was because I was stuck 6 years ago thinking to myself that there was something wrong with me because I didn't know what my purpose was. And it has taken so many conversations. And one in particular, I spoke to an organizational psychologist who used to teach me philosophy back when I was doing my MBA in Australia. And what he said during the podcast really shifted my mindset as to how I look at purpose. Because back in the day, I saw purpose as this static overnight aha moment. You go through some sort of framework questions and then you find it and then you wake up the next day and then you'll be okay. But then in the conversation with him, he said that even Nelson Mandela was not fully self-actualized because purpose is an ongoing, lifelong discovery journey. And as your life expands, as your life evolves, your purpose can also change too. And I remember that conversation really shift how I used to look at purpose and how I look at purpose now.
Mm.
And then when I distill all the conversations that I've had with great leaders like yourself, there are three common elements within transformative purpose. One is to lead with passion. Second is to just be a better self, focus on the micro 1% improvement. And then the last one is about making a human impact. As you rise, make sure you're also helping other people around you to rise together, which is why we have a tagline called Evolve, like leaders evolve together, because I really believe in leaders where they're not just evolving for themselves, but they're evolving for their teams and for everyone else around them. So the Purpose Club, we gather once a month and very diverse group of leaders from all walks of life coming together. We have a curated topic. And the intention is just to help people to take a strategic pause, grow, and then evolve together as a community.
And for listeners that would like to become involved in that, how do they find you?
They can find us on LinkedIn, or they can just type in the URL, www.thepurposeclub.co.
All right. And we met, of course, at a previous guest of mine on Helen's Law Matters. That's Mahesh Harilela.
Yeah.
And he was involved in, on the occasion we met, in five young people talking about their journey academically. And they were all superstars.
Yeah.
And you might recall the question I asked at the end was well, what about those that aren't superstars? What about the guys and gals that are struggling in life, particularly after COVID, so many young people's education being interrupted? So have you got any thoughts on particularly, actually, the people that are now in their late teens whose time at school was so badly interrupted by COVID?
Great question. And I'm really grateful that you asked that question, because that was the question that I wanted to ask when I was sitting in the audience. When I look at the challenges that a lot of young people are facing, and they're facing a lot, they're facing a lot of noises, things that are happening in Gaza, they make me really upset as a parent. But they also made me feel really grateful that we are in such a safe environment that we can spend time with our children, not worrying about safety and not worrying about food or bombs being dropped over our head any moment. So that taught me a lot. That gave me a moment for gratitude. Now, for other young people, and this is actually my real story, right? So after I got switched into a new school, I was never the top three. I was never the student that got praise or won awards. In fact, I shared my examination report not too long ago. I was a bottom three. I was always a late bloomer. I hated the local educational system, never fit in, and spent a very long time just trying to fit into a system where I don't belong. And that's also part of the premise of my next book, Give Me a Moment. And one of the messages that I wanted to get out there is sometimes people are not performing, not because there's an issue with their innate personality or innate capability. It could well be because they are not in the right system, or they haven't met the right people who really believe in them. And I go back to my childhood. I started as bottom three, not top three. I started writing when I was 35 with no writing experience. I only had a goal. I only wanted to become a global inspirational author for the next generation. So the purpose was not about me. It was about serving other people. I started a podcast for the exact same reason. I started doing public speaking for the exact same reason. And I go back to the power of purpose. When you start doing things that you have passion for and you be laser focused, go on this digital detox, be very focused on just brushing up that single skill where you have passion for. And then you anchor yourself, not around your ego, but anchor yourself around the people that you want to serve. I would say that the transformative power of doing things purposefully, because you're no longer serving yourself, you're empowering people around you. And as you rise, the people that you inspire are also rising together with you. And we are in this society where often high achievers get praise, but then at the same time, people are saying, how does Hong Kong reinvent? How can we become more entrepreneurial? Because we need to have a fundamental shift in our culture. Instead of praising for achievements and awards, we should be praising for failures and people for repeatedly trying, right? We wouldn't have life today had Edison given up after his first experiment, but we have life today because he hadn't given up. After 9,999 times, he was still going. So the question that we'll ask back is, with everything that we do as a society, as a company, how many chances are we giving to our people to show up, experiment, and fail? And are we rewarding those equally with those who have tried and succeeded? There needs to be a better balance.
Absolutely. Listening to that, resonate more than you know. May I, for a moment, give you an anecdotal of my own? So you were in the bottom three of your class. And when I was, I think, probably 9 years old, perhaps 10 years old, I was at a boarding school in Yorkshire. It's called Malsis. It doesn't exist anymore, but it's called Malsis. And the headmaster wrote to my parents and said, would you please think about removing Jonathan from this school to one less academically minded, because we don't think that he's got any possibility of passing any exams in his life. So that was at the age of 9 or 10, I was being written off. So my parents dutifully changed me to another school up on the north coast in Yorkshire. But when I eventually passed, I think it was my 27th law exam to qualify as a solicitor, my mother took some pleasure in writing a very polite letter to the headmaster saying that, in fact, his judgment had been incorrect and Jonathan had qualified as a solicitor of the Supreme Court of England and Wales, to which the headmaster wrote back saying, I'm so sorry, it was obviously my mistake. And by the way, as I went through all of school, I was never in the top half. I was always in the middle to bottom half. Part of it's because I'm dyslexic. So I can resonate with this. And I think one of the reasons, I've said this before on podcasts, that one of the reasons I'm a criminal defense solicitor is because I want to help the underdog. I want to help the one that's failing. The ones that are successful don't need your help or mine.
Yeah.
It is exactly the underbelly of society, very largely, where people are really in difficulty and in pain, financially, emotionally, and trying to swim against the tide.
Mm.
Aaron, thank you for coming along. I'm hoping that listeners will find this interesting as I have, because it's a bit of a diversion for Howlin's Law Matters, but it's a very, very good diversion, and I think a very necessary one. And I hope that people who feel they need help will reach out to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.